ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Youth crime keeps making national headlines, but it's not new or confined to any one state or territory. Leaders and communities across regional Australia continue to roll out youth programs, trialling new and recycling old approaches. Hundreds of thousands of dollars are spent, but what is actually working? We'll head to Kununurra shortly to look at solutions focused on supporting young people at risk and their families.
It's not easy to be living in a place in our communities and in our remote communities. So, we must give the opportunities to our young people in order to break that intergenerational trauma. But what about the parents? Where are the support for our communities? Where's community resourcing? Why aren't our parents given the driver's seat in a lot of these issues?
That story soon. And is it as idyllic as it sounds? Caretaking a 150-year-old lighthouse on a desert island.
The composting toilet needs to be raked down and evened out and then emptied now and then. Those sort of jobs don't bother me in the slightest.
I'm Alex Barwick and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Aranda Country in Mbantwa, Alice Springs. First, we head to the copper city of Cobar in western New South Wales, where a man and a woman are dead after an explosion at an underground mine. Emergency service crews were called to the mine in Cobar, about 450 kilometres east of Broken Hill, in the early hours of the morning, after reports two people had been critically injured in a workplace incident. Reporter Oliver Brown is in Cobar. Thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Pleasure, Alex.
Tell us what happened at the mine on the outskirts of town there.
Yeah, so Alex, at about 3:45 on Tuesday morning, emergency service crews were called to the mine on Endeavour Mine Road. So the mine itself is about 40 kilometres north of Cobar, and upon arriving, they started looking into the situation. Two people had been brought to the service in the aftermath of this incident, which is believed to be an explosion, after one man was already confirmed to be deceased due to the explosion. As I said, two women were brought to the surface. Unfortunately, one did pass away. A second woman has since been flown to hospital, suffering hearing damage and shock. So obviously for a mining community, it's something that really hits straight to the core. So everyone's really devastated.
Yeah, I mean, it's a small town. I understand the population's around 4,000. It would be felt so hard across the community.
Absolutely. I mean, we've only had a short period of time here on the ground, but speaking to the people we have, it's one of those communities where everyone knows everyone. There's some sort of link in some form or another, and everyone just seems to be sad. It's obviously such a sad situation, and they deeply feel impacted by it, and especially for in relation to an industry that has kept the city alive for so many years, and is integral to the city's economy as well. It's just something that they really can't process right now. We spoke to Mayor Jared Marsden of Cobar Shire Council just a little bit earlier, and he just said it's such a difficult thing to process.
I guess it's just about coming together. I mean, a town like Cobar, you know, small, tight-knit town, people will come together. You know, people grieve differently and at different speeds. You know, there'll be a lot of human emotion, raw emotion this week, and it's all about coming together and supporting one another. And as an individual, you don't need to be a macho man and hide in the corner and keep it all bottled into yourself. There's the churches have opened their doors. If you want to go and sit in a corner and have some time to yourself, there's the employee assistance programs available at all the mines in Cobar, not just Endeavour, that have counsellors attached to them.
Mayor Jared Marsden there. Oliver, at this stage, how much is known about what caused that explosion?
Well, Alex, what I can confirm for you, there's no exact cause that's been reported as of yet, but what I can say is that the New South Wales Resources Regulator has launched an investigation into that cause. We've heard from so many community members about their immediate thoughts on the incident, and speaking to the Mayor, Jared Marsden, just earlier today, he said that he is putting faith into that investigation, and he really hopes that whatever aftermath of that is, ultimately makes the industry safer going forward. He says that mining deaths do happen in an industry like this. They sometimes... accidents happen, but it is still quite a rare occurrence. So he hopes that for every incident, as tragic as they are, he hopes that there can be learning from them. And that's what he's hoping will happen in the situation here.
And police have held a press conference. What was said at that?
Yeah, so police held the press conference in Cobar on the ground on Tuesday as well, pretty much outlining the early stages of the investigation, offering their sympathies to the community, and really outlining again how rare these sort of situations happen and the importance of investigating them appropriately and whatever time that will take.
You know, people come to work expecting to go home, even though mining can be a dangerous operation. It's very well regulated by the regulator and by responsible mine owners. And it's tragic, and it's something that actually impacts not only the families but also the Cobar community, because I know it has a strong attachment to mining in this town, and also extended to those 200 other families, you know, of all the other employees that work at the mine site.
Thanks so much, Oliver.
Thanks, Alex.
Reporter Oliver Brown there in Cobar in regional New South Wales.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
To Kununurra now in northern WA. Youth crime continues to be a dominant issue across regional centres right around the country, and Kununurra is no exception. Recently, another group of young people have been arrested after a ute was allegedly stolen and driven erratically through the town. It follows a string of car stealing and high-speed incidents, sometimes involving kids as young as 10. So what solutions do community leaders believe can create permanent change when a nighttime drop-in centre in Kununurra doesn't open until late next year? Julia Battolio has the story. She began by speaking here with Gidja Walmajari man, Ian Trust, the chair of the Woonan Foundation.
I mean, there's a fair amount of goodwill from the community in regards to what we should do here. You know, the community is not polarised between Aboriginals and non-Aboriginals. I think everyone's want to try and get the best outcome for Kununurra.
Ian Trust says both short-term and long-term solutions are needed.
So we've got to come up with some innovative ideas as to how we engage with this youth. And so some of them aren't, a lot of them, you know, the group that we're talking about aren't going to just fit back into a classroom. We're going to have to come up with some innovative programs that excites them and also challenges them. I think a lot of them sort of like to learn, but it's just that they aren't going to go back into a school and sit in an English class or mathematics class, and where they've sort of lost, you know, too many years before that. So I think that that's the challenge: is how do we do that?
The state government has provided funding for a night space in Kununurra, due to be completed by mid next year. WA Deputy Premier Rita Saffioti says the government wants to partner with local organisations to provide wraparound services.
It's about keeping. Some kids, unfortunately, just don't have a home environment in which they can succeed in. And so, as awful as it is, that's why we need these other services. As confronting as it is, that's why you need other services to ensure that they get fed and that they're occupied and they see a pathway out of maybe the experience that they sometimes see in other parts of the community.
While extra officers are on the ground in Kununurra, police and locals agree they cannot arrest their way out of the problem.
You've got to have some sort of police response to that to keep the place safe and the community feeling safe. But there's got to be a longer term sort of solution as well, or strategies that are trying to address the underlying issues as to why this is happening. You've got to do something about the immediate safety of the community in terms of law and order, but there's also the issues about what do you do about the families in the long run, in the long term, in terms of trying to help these kids and these families create a better life for themselves. So I think there's two aspects to it, and it's got to address both aspects. The immediate one, of course, is safety and, you know, just in regard to people feeling safe in the community, but the longer term issue is what do you do about helping families that are struggling to go forward and come up with, you know, a better option for themselves, you know, in their lives in terms of the years to come. Well, the major sort of things is people having no role and purpose in life, you know, not engaged with the education system, not engage with the economic opportunities that Australia has to offer. They don't sort of, they're not involved in those opportunities. And so there are lots of opportunities around, but you've got to have the ability to be able to take advantage of it. And a lot of the people in the families we're talking about don't have the ability to do that. So one of the challenges for us is, how do we help them, you know, create those or get the ability to be able to sort of take advantage of those opportunities?
19-year-old Tremaine Baxter Edwards, a youth leader in the East Kimberley, says better opportunities can help people succeed.
When opportunity arises for young people, they can take it with both hands and create something for themselves. And so that's what I told people is, you know, you look at all the social factors that play into youth crime, I guess, and youth justice. And, you know, young people can change, but you just need to give them the opportunity. You need to give them the time. We must remember that young people in communities, they are, unfortunately, they don't have a lot. They don't have a lot to do. There aren't a lot of opportunities. And in saying that, the continued support for the young people must be given as well. So you can't just say, here's the opportunity, and not give the continued support. And I think that's what a lot of people in particular from, from the city, from Perth, let's just say, because I've lived in Perth and I can see how different it is living in community and living in the city. And so what people fail to realise is it's easy to throw money or to give opportunities to people, but without the support, that's where it fails.
But Mr. Baxter Edwards says for real change to happen, a more holistic approach is needed.
I think a lot of people, they resort to, and I quote, bad parenting. Now they say, oh, it's where are the parents? The parents need the support too. People don't realise that the parents are struggling too. It's not easy to be living in a place like in our communities and in our remote communities. So, we must give the opportunities to our young people in order to break that intergenerational trauma. But what about the parents? Where are the support for our communities? Where's community resourcing? Why aren't our parents given the driver's seat in a lot of these issues?
Wyndham youth leader Tremaine Baxter Edwards ending that story from Julia Bertolio. We head an hour and a half southwest of Sydney next. 9 months after production was paused at the Tarmoor coal mine, around half of its 500-strong workforce has now been stood down without pay. The shutdown is the latest setback for GFG Alliance, the company owned by Indian-born billionaire Sanjeev Gupta, which has been battling global financial pressures. The uncertainty is rippling through the tight-knit community. Kelly Fuller reports from Tarmoor.
At an inn southwest of Sydney in the village of Tarmoor, more than 150 mine workers gathered after receiving some bad news on Friday afternoon.
Go through some of the more common questions that we've been asked over the last few days, and I guess over a longer period. And then we'll open up the floor to you guys, to ask any questions that you guys might have. We'll do our best to answer what we can.
Half the workforce at the Tarmoor coal mine has been stood down, this time without pay. On Friday, labour hire firm Arstar told its contractors it can't continue wages while the mine remains closed. Despite the setback, the workers described the meeting as open and hopeful. Among them was Mark Bryant, an operator at Tarmoor Mine who works for Arstar.
To be honest, really fortunate. We've obviously been on a standby arrangement with pay. While they work out the financial difficulties with the mine. Obviously, they've got to a point where they're owed a lot of money that they can no longer pay us. You know, it was very good to have a meeting today to kind of talk that through with them and try and resolve this matter as best as we can, as soon as we can.
Mark Bryan says Arstar's been upfront about the situation and is still working with the mine owner, GFG Alliance, to find a way forward.
You know, we don't know how long this is going to go for. Obviously, they're very supportive. They're available to any of the workers who, you know, have questions beyond the meeting today. We just need to work together to get the matter resolved, get us back underground.
The company is owed what Mark Bryant says is a significant amount.
It's in excess of 10 weeks' wages for their 250-odd employees, and that's just workers underground. That doesn't include their There's surface stuff.
GFG Alliance says it received $25 million in bridging finance earlier this month to help sustain operations, but a delay in the next funding round has held up payments. The company says it's confident the matter will be resolved soon and that restarting the mine remains its top priority. Today, workers wanted answers. How much money they were owed, why they were stood down without pay, and what leave options were available. Mark Bryant says most workers can cope now, but not for long.
It's going to get very difficult for families, especially depending on their situations if they haven't been able to put extra money away. Me personally, I can absorb it for a couple of weeks. Beyond that, I'm not too sure. That's only because during this situation, I've realised that this could have happened at any time, so I needed to be a couple of weeks in front just in case of this situation, but I can't speak on behalf of what other people's bills and commitments are. I believe that if this was to continue for an extended period of time being beyond sort of 2 weeks, you'd start to see some effects on those families and communities.
Local State Independent MP Judy Hannon says the workers and community deserve better and the owner should either start operations again or sell the mine.
It's time to give up whatever your game is, give it up, let our work, get, you know, have somebody else come and take over and let our workers get back to work and let's you know, mend the bridges for those people that have sat there so patiently for such a long time. Time is run out. Let's get a resolution.
Bob Timms from the Mining and Energy Union wants the government to intervene and revoke the operator's licence.
I am going to call on the state government to intervene and under whatever power they can apply, take the lease off Sanjeev Gupta, force him into administration, do something.
Mark Bryant remains optimistic the mine will reopen.
8 or 9 longwall blocks approved for extraction for some really good quality coal, and the best people to have there getting that coal out is the people who've been working there for, you know, 3, 4, 5, 20, 30 years. So I can't see Tarmor not operating in some way, shape or form, and I have been positive through this whole period.
Kelly Fuller with that story. Now to Swan Reach, more than 160 kilometres from Adelaide. A groundbreaking South Australian study has found access to road accident compensation is failing First Nations people. The research shows compensation schemes are not culturally safe and don't cater to the needs of Aboriginal people. Shannon Pearce reports.
Njarrindjeri woman Talia Scriven grew up on country along the banks of the River Murray, where her father, Darryl Rigney, could heal from the trauma of losing his leg in a car accident at 18.
I can see how happy he is out in the bush. Like, his emotional well-being really needed that.
Just feels complete. There's nothing missing, you know? I feel like I've learnt what I've never known before out here. Psychologically, it fixes you up, no worries.
Talia is an adult now and is reflecting on her childhood. While the army covered her dad's medical costs after the accident, she wonders how different her life could have been if he and her whole family had received more supportive compensation.
There's still that chunk that I think was missing holistically as a family, and little aspects of that are stuff like financial support or transport support. The emotional mental health sort of support for us as a family, including mum, really lacked.
Talia's family struggled being so far from services. She says if her family received support on country, it would have made a big difference.
Getting Dad up to Adelaide to have a leg fitting for his prosthetic leg, mum would have had to have taken a financial cut because she's going a day without work. We're also taking a day off of school because nobody would be here to pick us up from school.
A recent study from Flinders University says Talia and Darryl's family is not alone. It says access to compensation is not a culturally safe or appropriate process.
These processes are actually designed for dominant populations and are not relational or representative for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. There's a whole element of marginalisation that is not actually considered. From a health equity perspective, you're already, you know, so much up against the system, I guess you could say. Quite often people will be dismissed or not considered within their claims and so forth.
Dr. Courtney Ryder led the first of its kind work in South Australia and says the system doesn't account for the additional needs of First Nations people, such as the impact of leaving country or the ongoing impact of an injury on important cultural values such as self-determination and connectedness. She says the processes are also too complex.
One individual talked about, you know, it took 5 years and they ended up just settling with what they had because they just got tired. They were worn down. Their mental health and well-being was significantly impacted from the ongoing toing and froing between it, that they just settled with what they had when they probably could have been compensated more.
She says many Indigenous people live in regional or remote areas and more effort needs to be put into reaching out to people to offer support and education on compensation rights.
They weren't even aware that they could access compensation or how to even go about the approach. It goes to the ingrained racism and the ongoing impacts of colonisation. Often individuals reported feeling sort of like blamed or that, you know, they were making up, you know, their injuries or their requirements around compensation and ongoing support as well.
Talia says her dad could have easily slipped through the cracks.
If he misses a phone call here and there, that's the opportunity missed. A lot of people didn't really chase him up.
Dr. Brett Shannon is an occupational health clinician, researcher and descendant of the Noongar people. He says being on country should be considered in the design of compensation schemes.
Dr. Ryder's work was kind of the first to show that, like, it is important in a compensation case and in a compensation environment as well that people want to stay on country. It's clearly been shown to sort of show when you're on country, it has tremendous sort of spiritual, emotional, psychological and even economical sort of improvements for Indigenous Australians if treatment can be provided there, and I know that their outcomes will be better.
Road accident compensation in Australia is handled individually by each state and territory. South Australia's Traffic Injury Compensation Regulator says its system is designed to support all eligible people and looks for ways to educate all claimants and motorists about the scheme. But it declined to say what it's doing to improve its processes. Dr. Shannon and Dr. Ryder are calling for change across the country.
Compensation and these claims is such an administrative heavy area of healthcare. It makes it very difficult to be accessible and be reactive.
It is going to take the right people. It's going to take a lot of will as well. But I'm hopeful that the different sort of compensation schemes are actually committed to do that. Culturally safe, equity-driven approaches that meet the needs of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities needs to be implemented across all schemes and processes.
The federal government says it will continue to work closely with state and territory compensation schemes and industry on road safety measures, including supporting better outcomes for First Nations people.
Shannon Pierce with that story.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And to Low Island off the coast of Port Douglas in far north Queensland. Many of us might dream of quitting our office jobs and running away to a remote tropical island. For Don and Lee Cameron, that's now a reality as they take care of a 150-year-old lighthouse on the Great Barrier Reef. But it's not quite as glamorous as you might think. Here's Josie Sargent with more.
Many of us dream of an island getaway from work, but for Don and Lee Cameron, their work is taking care of a dream tropical island. They are the new live-in caretakers of Low Isles, a coral cay in tropical North Queensland. And the job interview for this unusual job asked some unusual questions.
Well, they wanted to know whether we'd be able to handle a relatively isolated environment. You have to be reasonably resourceful because there's no big hardware store just down the road. The supermarket's 12 or 15 kilometres away by boats.
The day-to-day tasks are straightforward: weeding, maintenance and greeting daily tourists. But not all the jobs are glamorous.
I'm very tough in the stomach department and things like that. The composting toilet needs to be raked down and evened out and then emptied now and then. Those sort of jobs don't bother me in the slightest. other people wouldn't quite cope. Friends I've told are just horrified.
The couple love to travel and have spent time taking care of other remote lighthouses across the country, as well as living on a boat.
We like the bush. We like hiking. We like working outside when I'm not an indoor person. I wouldn't give you two hoots for city and shopping. We just like rough outdoors and relying on your own ingenuity to keep going.
They stumbled upon the job ad by chance.
If you live in Tasmania, we live in the bush up on top of a hill, so we look down all over the Derwent River. It's heavy bush, very cold, very windy, and then you read about a tropical island. Why not? We heard it via a LIPS volunteer. She told me about it, so I Googled, and here we are.
But the humidity is a big change for the Tasmanian locals.
It's certainly a bit of a shock going from spring in Tasmania, where we've had some quite wild and cold weather, along with snow and all the rest of it, coming to this. So it was quite a pleasant change from the cold. But, we've got to learn to cope with the wet season humidity, which is coming up.
Lee and Don acknowledge it's not a job for everyone. It's remote, it's busy, and the island is small.
I was confronted by the size of the island. It was smaller than I thought. But honestly, I think if I had a step counter, I'd be doing more steps on this island, walking around, raking, checking, than I would at home. I'm a person who believes if you sit still for too long, you get old. I'm just not ready to get old yet.
They think caring for a tropical island is the best job in the world.
The island itself, everything about it, it's just beautiful. The snorkeling's excellent. They could turn the temperature down a little bit.
That story from reporter Christopher Tesla and Josie Sargent.
ABC Australia Wide.
This is our history. This is Australia's history as much as anything.
On ABC Radio.
And finally, we head to the ocean. A satellite tracking device that was once attached to the fin of a 4.5-metre great white shark has been found on a Queensland beach, revealing the large distance that shark had travelled. Kiwi shark expert Dr. Riley Elliott has been tracking the movements of 20 sharks as they move between Australia, New Zealand and Polynesia. When one of his expensive tracking devices fell off the shark, he took to social media to see if someone could find it. Enter Tracy Martin at Mermaid Beach in Queensland.
One of the sharks I hadn't heard from at all in 8 months, and then I get a detection up at Rainbow Beach. And then I realise that the tags actually come off the shark up there and started floating down the coast. And it's hard to find in the middle of the ocean, even just a few kilometres offshore, but when it made land on one of the most populated, beautiful beaches in the world, being Mermaid Beach, I just put on social media, hey, is anyone on this beach who can look for this tag? And within 10 minutes, ironically, an ex-girlfriend from high school had her kids at Nippers, and they found it within 5 minutes, which was incredible.
Very, very random. I probably haven't spoken to Riley for maybe over 20 years. I opened up my Facebook and just saw this post, and I was like, this is so ironic. I messaged him and I'm like, you're never going to believe this, but my kids actually go to Mermaid Nippers and we're literally getting ready to go there right now.
We use a very least invasive method, which is basically like an ear piercing. It's a dart and tether tag.
One of the nippers had found it like sitting by the showers, so obviously someone had come across it while they were maybe on a beach walk or something and put it up by the showers thinking that somebody would claim it. It's not that big. Like, it was probably, the main part of it is probably a little bit bigger than my hand. And then it had like a few sort of like wires and a little antenna coming off it. I don't even know how to explain it.
Yeah, I said to them, I was like, oh my gosh, you guys, you're holding a shark tracker that's been like attached to a shark that someone's been, you know, tracking.
It was called Davenport. It was 4 meters long, female. And that's a big shark, right? I saw the shark in the flesh. I placed a tag on its back. We got genetic samples from it. We got a bunch of photo ID from it. And then you don't hear from it for 8 months, and it swims that far underwater, of which I just did a flight recently up there. And I was thinking, how do they swim this far? How do they navigate this? How do they do this? It's incredible. And the sharks go up there for New Zealand's winter because it's cold down here, and you guys always have beautiful weather. And then around about this time of year, coming to Christmas time, when it's warm enough to swim in New Zealand, the sharks tend to come back. I think there's so much irony in this, like, let alone the home and away story you just kind of said. But, like, the fact that these kids are surf life-saving nippers, and then they went on the app, the Great White app, and saw where the shark had come from. You know, the more we learn about these animals, the more we can strip back the boogeyman mentality.
Yeah, they were so excited. They were just like, oh my gosh, that's so cool, and where's it come from, and everything. So there was nothing about, oh my God, is the shark out there? Or they were scared. They thought it was really cool.
And I'm getting it back tomorrow because my friend is flying back. Pretty cool. And I think that positivity around sharks is just fantastic.
That's Dr. Riley Elliott and Tracy Martin recalling the story of the lost and then found shark tracker. And that's Australia Wide for today. My name's Alex Barwick. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen.